We were just in downtown Birmingham. We're in Woodlawn now at the studio. Yep. Remind me what studio we're in.
This is the Pipe and Gun and Communicating Vessels studio.
Yeah,
and the two labels I'm affiliated with.
And you're currently working in this studio. Is this a daily thing for you to be here?
I come here as often as I can. I mean, I'm fortunate that I have a key to this space, and I keep different hours than a lot of normal musicians. A lot of people are up all night. I get up real early, so I can swing by here at 7 in the morning and write a song, and there's nobody here.
Well, it's a pretty beautiful facility.
It's incredibly beautiful.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an example of the thought process and attention to detail that both those labels pay to the art they're creating and putting out.
So we were just downtown, and you were getting a haircut. We were at a barbershop, and we were talking off mic a little bit about barbershops, and you said you could take me on a barbershop tour of Birmingham and Woodlawn as we were driving through. Mm-hmm. It seems that you have a bit of a fascination with barbershops.
I have a complete fascination with barbershops.
Would it be a fascination or an obsession with them?
Some people would tell me it's an obsession. To the point where when I had my band Gum Creek Killers, they used to tease me that I should have a website called Barbershop Junkie because I love barbershops and the culture of it. And there's a lot of reasons for that. In growing up when I was really small, I had long, messy hair. I mean, my parents were hippies. But the first time I went to a barbershop as a young kid, you know, it used to be that in any barbershop, whether you're white, black, Asian, Hispanic, it didn't matter. It's where men would take their sons. Well, in certain aspects in America, it got divided to where, you know, barbershop has always been a mainstay in the African American community, in the black community. But in white culture, people started going to hair salons. Moms would take their boys, less dads were involved. And I think people started losing that rite of passage. To me, taking your son to a barbershop is a rite of passage into manhood, right? It's where you can learn to be a man.
Why do you think that is?
I think men need a place to go to where they can talk about being a man, whether it doesn't matter your socioeconomic background. There is common ground in a barbershop. Everybody, when you're in there, you're just another man, you know? So I think boys that are raised going to a barbershop learn conversation, learn to shake hands, learn to talk. Like, that aspect has been lost in a lot of American culture, except for in the black community.
And you're a father, and you have another child on the way, and
yep,
it'll be a young man, a baby boy is on the way.
Yes.
It sounds to me like you guys are eventually going to be going to a barbershop together.
We will be going to a barbershop, or I'm going to own one, and he'll be coming to the one I own.
And you cut a little hair, don't you?
I do cut hair, yes. And I'm not a licensed barber, but I used to cut my own hair for years. And then, fortunately, I only had one really bad haircut I gave myself. Unfortunately, it was right before my wedding, and my wife about killed me. But right before I wrote the Etowah record, when I was locked up in Etowah County Detention Center thinking I was going to prison, I knew I needed to have some sort of trade. No one was going to give me money. No, I had no family to send me money in jail. If I went to jail, you're a big boy. You made your bed. You better lie in it and deal with it. So I started cutting guys' hair, and it's also a way to stay safe as long as you give good haircuts. So it started there, and then I just kept getting more and more into it, and I found it therapeutic to be able to go to a barber shop and just get touched up, you know, and have conversations with guys.
I mean, there's a much more hands-on quality to a barbershop. I mean, we were just sitting in Blevins Barbershop in downtown, and I mean, it's been forever since I've been in there. I mean, you have these places like Sport Clips and salons, and there's no intimacy to them at all. There's not much personality to these places, but barbershops, there's something very old-fashioned and very, it just feels homey, I guess, and you have this usually man who's just putting his hands on your head and being very delicate with you and very precise. What is it about that that you love so much?
Well, you know, it's different with different barbershops. With Bob, it's incredibly special to me because he's like a grandfather to me. You know, I mean, Bob's 75 years old, one of the few master barbers in this city that I know of. And there's something really comforting. And I know guys that they feel this way about their young barbers. Like, you have that bond and that connection with your barber because you're trusting. When you have someone, Bob doesn't do straight razor shaves anymore, but when you have someone that's putting a razor that close to your neck, you better trust him. You know?
Well, you shot a video for the song Got Lost and Stayed in a barbershop.
Yep.
Why did you want to shoot that there?
Well, that happened purely on circumstance. I went down to 4th Avenue North to shoot a video walking down the street, but there was nobody hanging out that day. And I didn't know why. And this barber came out of a barbershop and started teasing me and calling me Bon Jovi. And we had this whole dialogue going around, you know, ripping on each other. And I was like, man, I do not sound like Bon Jovi. I don't know what you've been watching on TV, but...
Or look like Bon Jovi.
Yeah, or look like Bon Jovi for that matter. And at the time, I was going to a friend of my wife's, and she gave me some good haircuts, but when she would do my fade, there was always kind of a line, and I didn't like that. And he said, well, play me a song. So I played him a song, and he liked it. And I asked him, I was like, well, can we come in and film in the barbershop? And he agreed to let me film the song in the barbershop as long as I let him fix my haircut. And that guy, his name was Chris, and he worked for Mr. Hornbuckle, who's been at Magic City Barbershop for 52 years on 4th Avenue North through the Civil Rights Movement, everything. Well, Chris became my barber that day and was my barber for 2 years. And then he moved back to Atlanta, and I started going back to Bob, and I wouldn't go to anyone else in this city, and I send any and every man to Bob, whether you have long hair, short hair. I mean, I wear a very classical, old school haircut.
Yeah.
And everyone thinks, oh, well, I can't go to Bob because I don't want my hair that short. And I tell them, a good barber should be able to cut your hair no matter what. But barbershops are about an experience. People think going to a place like Supercuts is an experience, but it's not. There's no connection. And more so, I think, than ever with technology, people need those connections when you get away from the web, because there's no connection when you're on the web. Mm-hmm. It's fake. It's not real. So you go into a barbershop, or like we ran into a group of my friends leaving the barbershop. There's three guys going to have a meal, go to the barbershop. They'll converse, they'll joke, they'll laugh, they'll get their hair done. It's a good bonding thing for men to do.
Well, and you mentioned that your haircut is kind of old-fashioned. You know, in some cases you might dress in an old-fashioned way, and people would probably say that they use the term roots with your music a lot when they describe it. The young men that we saw outside of the barbershop just a few moments ago, their haircuts were kind of an old-fashioned style, and their fashion and their style in general was... What is it about old fashioned? What is it, are you trying to reach back for any particular reason these days?
No, and I don't think I'm trying to reach back. I'm trying to just carry on a tradition of like quality. When it comes to fashion, I think it used to be that men took pride in their appearance, and in certain cultures that's never left. You know, like before the holidays, you go to a barbershop in the black community, every man's in there, his son's in there. That's what it's about, man. Like looking good for your friends, your family, whatever it may be. I'm not necessarily trying to look back. I'm just trying to, for me, everything's about quality. And in men's fashion for years, that disappeared. But through blogging and men's fashion blogs over the past several years, there's been a massive resurgence. And what's beautiful about it is that it's not geared towards a white guy. It's not geared toward an Asian guy, a Hispanic guy. It's universal, like just men wearing clothes that fit right, having a good cut, whether it's long or short, paying attention to the details, you know?
Well, and I know that you won't even let bandmates wear shorts. You won't let them wear open-toed shoes on stage. So fashion is important to you.
It's completely important to me. And the rule with like the open-toed shoes is like, I mean, take some pride in what you're doing, you know? Like, I know pride can be a dangerous thing. Like, my buddy Thad has a song called Pride Won't Get You Where You're Going. Man, why in the heck would you get on stage wearing flip-flops? I mean, I don't understand it.
Yeah.
You know?
It's not a superficial thing with you. It's
No, it's not superficial.
It's a quality of life. It's a presentation thing. Because, I mean, in music now, I find, especially locally, and you see it at the national and mainstream level too, it's become fairly superficial in that it's more of a fashion show than it is about any substance when it comes to the music. Yep. I mean, if you look at something like, for example, like a show like American Idol or any of these shows that are on mainstream television, it's more important what they're wearing than it is the quality of their voices and the quality of music that they're bringing. And I see it again at the local level. I think that there are some artists out there who are more concerned about whether or not their tie matches their bass than they are about the actual music. Do you think it's a little dangerous to focus too heavily on that? Because when it comes down to it, it seems like music comes first.
Music comes first. There's a thin line, for sure. There's people that need to pay more attention to it, and there's people that need to pay less attention to it. I do have rules for my band, but, you know, I don't want anyone matching stuff. But it's also to make it to where it is about the music. For me, I'm very purposeful in the way the band sets up on stage, the way the band dresses, so that people aren't I'd rather have everybody in all black, so you're not trying to figure out what people are wearing. You're hearing the music. I don't set up where I'm standing in the center of the stage and I'm the focus of attention because I don't want to be, because I'm creating music with a group of people, and it does me no good. I am not up there to be a performer, to be a monkey dancing for people. Some people are. But for me, this is my room. When I'm on stage, I'm welcoming you to our experience.
You came to see me?
And not necessarily me. You came to hear music. So I want to set up to where the band is focused on each other. The band right. sees each other.
Like a U-shaped thing.
Yes, I always set up in a horseshoe so we see each other. And as long as we're focused on creating the best music we can for each other, it's going to read to the crowd.
It is a fine line. Though, to touch on the clothes thing again, because I don't know if you know the recent news with the band Arcade Fire, where
I've heard a little bit.
There's been a little chatter on social media about how they have requested that their fans and those who attend their shows wear formal wear. It's mandatory that you wear formal attire, and it's angered some of the fans. You would never ask people coming to your show to wear something, would
you? Hell no. I mean, look, wearing formal, I think they're maybe their ticket sales suck or something, and they're trying to grasp at something, or maybe they were just so successful they don't care and they can be real weird.
Right.
But telling people to wear formal wear, and I thought there was something about wearing a costume. And,
yeah.
And that's okay for one show.
Yeah.
Like, hey, we're doing the like special Halloween, event, maybe. Halloween or whatever it may be, but why would you want to dictate to your audience what they should be wearing?
Yeah, I saw somebody write on Facebook or something, okay, I'll wear formal wear to your show if you start making interesting records again.
I saw that, and I know who it was. We won't mention names, but that was brilliant.
Well, speaking of, again, the barbershop thing, you just released a video for your song Dancing Song from your latest album, Rabbit Runs of Destiny, which is available now. This was directed by Tyler Jones and shot in East Lake, Alabama. Is that correct?
Yes, in my backyard.
Talk about that shoot and sort of where the idea came from. It's an interesting video.
Well, I talked about a video of me cutting somebody's hair for a while because I'm trying to write. I mean, I love collaborating with people, and that's why I love working with 1504s, because they're open to the collaboration. But I had this idea to where I wanted different people to sing the song while I cut their hair. And I thought it fit that song as long as we had the right tone to the video. And then my buddy Scotty Lee posted, "Where's a good barber?" And I at first was just going to offer to pay to send him to Bob as like a present for being a cool guy. And he was going to cut his hair all the way off. And then Matt Lane Harris, one of my closest friends and one of my son's godfathers, Matt texted me and said, "Brother, like, this is the opportunity for you to cut Scotty's hair." Because everyone's been joking, what are we going to do when Bob retires? You got to learn how to be a barber. So I just started doing it. So I contacted Scotty and asked if he'd be down. And I wrote up a shot list for Tyler. And, you know, we met a few times. And, man, we shot that video really quick.
Well, it seems like you shot it in the day that it takes place.
We did.
Yeah? Because, I mean, it goes from daylight to dusk.
Yep.
They're in the same. Yeah, so it seems like it was one day of a shoot. And plus, you're cutting the guy's hair, so that you have continuity issues.
Yeah, continuity issues, and, you know, you got one shot to do it right. And his hair was so long. I mean, we had to finish cutting some of it off camera.
Yeah, he walked out of there with a pretty interesting look, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. How'd you feel about the job you did there?
I thought I did a great job. Yeah, I got a bunch more people contacting me after they saw his haircut. I mean, because you saw the beginning. I mean, he went from long hair to just a classic cut. I need to get in touch with him and touch it up. But, I mean, I've got another friend that's coming over tonight. I'm cutting his hair at 7 o'clock in my living room.
Well,
I'll give him a glass of bourbon and cut his hair, you know, and we'll talk.
Would you say that with this new album, as some have suggested it, you're shaking off the straightforward singer-songwriter style that marked your earlier releases?
Am I shaking it off? I think,
I mean, that's been written, so I'm just, that's one description of it.
I just don't want to be, I'm not a singular writer, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? What used to happen with me is anytime I had a new album sound I wanted to make, I would create a new band. But it was all sort of, the common thread was the way I wrote. But this time I found a producer in Armand that I trusted to take the roots, stripped down songs I'm writing, and how can we expand them and change them and shift them, and how can we create? Because I wanted to sonically create what I saw visually when I write. What I write out lyrically and with songs, I see stories, and it paints pictures for me in my head mm-hmm. when I'm doing it. So to create, I use the term sonic landscape. We are trying to create a painting, so to speak, with sounds. And so I'm shaking it a little bit, and it's just because I'm going to do what I want to do, whether people like it or not, when it comes to my music.
And with descriptions, you know, we talked about roots and genres that might be attached to you, given to you by other people. I don't know necessarily how you describe your own music. I mean, when people assign genres to you and those kinds of descriptions, does that bug you at all as an artist or any artist you know?
You know, it's tough because people ask you all the time, well, how do you describe your sound? What do you fit in? People need to be able to categorize. They don't know how to sell it or market it or do anything else if they can't put it into some sort of category.
Right.
So it doesn't bother me, but what bothers me is when people, like lately, keep trying to have me either do a tour with somebody. I'm like, have you listened to my new record? Because you're trying to put me on the road with a folk singer, and with this album, it just won't work that way.
A few years ago, that might have worked.
A few years ago, it would have been great, but now it doesn't. The common thread is the way I write is it's the same. It's how I'm recording it and presenting it live that's changed. Mm-hmm.
So you're making it a little difficult to categorize what you do because, I mean, you have several years of not necessarily folky. I mean, I would consider it straight rock, and if you want to throw roots rock in there, that's fine.
Yeah.
But now you're doing something completely different.
Yeah.
And you're not making it hard on anybody necessarily, but in terms of like pairing you up with a certain artist, people are going to have to think a little bit harder.
Good. Use their brains. You know what I mean? I want people to think. I think it's real easy to dumb things down in this day and age with technology. People want to, there's a difference between simplifying things and dumbing things down. Mm-hmm. And I want people to have to think. A lot of industry people, though, don't like that. And that's probably why they don't work with me because they can't, you know. You take a band that can play at a wedding, and if they have some original songs, people are like, great. Well, yeah, that's just easy, mindless entertainment. You know what I mean? Like, if I see a band on stage at the Bottle Tree, and I'm like, yeah, I saw this at a wedding 2 weeks ago, what's interesting about that? I'm not knocking them. Do whatever you're called to do and write whatever music you want to do, but to me, the music I'm creating, it's going to take you actually maybe using your brain a little bit to pay attention and to absorb what I'm creating.
So Rabbit Runs a Destiny is produced by Armand, help me with his last name.
Marjeka.
And this album has gotten attention nationally.
Oh, yeah.
NPR profiled the album and brought folks' attention to it. How did that come about? I mean, you've been around a while and people know about your music, but this sort of popped up.
I've definitely been around a while. I mean, I've been making music for 22 years, and as a solo artist, my first official record came out in 2006. And the NPR thing came about because a friend of mine in Nashville, who's a lawyer that is a good advisor and friend, he told me that I needed to meet this radio guy who's also a manager, my friend Paul Brown. And Paul and I had a conversation, just talking, didn't know each other, just chatted. I sent him the music, and after we got off the phone, I started getting followed on social media by all this stuff from WXPN and Bruce Warren, who's the executive producer of World Cafe. And I sent Bruce a message and was like, hey, I'm a huge fan. I hope we can meet one day. Apparently, we have a bunch of mutual friends. And Bruce just happened to write me back saying, no, email me. I want to talk to you seriously. And it turned out there was some confusion. I thought they had the new record, but they didn't. They had been listening to the Rugged and Fancy record for 3 years and apparently thought I was kind of an obscure underground artist. And then suddenly Paul sends them my new EP, and they had no idea I was still out there making records. So it literally was word of mouth. Sean from Day Trotter had sent him Rugged and Fancy, and my buddy Paul sent him the new stuff. And it just, they've been incredibly kind and supportive.
We're going to get back to the new album.
Sure.
Or the latest album anyway. But you were born in Franklin, Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
And you wound your way up in Alabama. But I want to talk to you about in Franklin or just in your household in general. I'm not sure. When did you move from Franklin? Did you live there for a while?
No. I don't know the exact time frame. There's a lot of my childhood stuff I don't remember. It's really weird. And I don't want to question it or figure out why.
Yeah.
Because maybe I'll bring up something I don't need to know. Some traumatic experience or some crap. But we moved to Wyoming not long after I was born. And so my family has been in Franklin in that area since the 1700s, and I still have family there, so my roots are there. Mm-hmm. My father and mom were kind of granolas, and so after I was born, they moved our whole family to a bunch of land in the mountains of Wyoming, and we grew crops, raised cattle, lived in tents, got bathed in creeks.
And this is, how old were you then?
Oh, I was a little bitty dude. I was 3 years
old. You remember this?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
It's hard to forget getting dunked in an ice cold creek in the middle of winter, lathered up, dunked back in, and then put by a fire to warm up.
Yeah, well, talk about that. What was that like? I mean, you must have vivid memories.
Man, I do have vivid memories, and that's the stuff I do remember. And it was incredible because I didn't know any different until I moved to Alabama. And I remember coming to Birmingham and having complete culture shock at the age of 7 because, one, I'd never watched television.
Yeah.
B, I'd never eaten fast food. And then suddenly I'm in the suburbs. And I didn't have tons of stuff.
Yeah. How did you wind up in Alabama?
My mom was from here.
Okay.
My mom was from Birmingham. And so after she and my dad split up, she wanted to come be close to her family to help out with things. So
growing up, whether it was in Wyoming, and I guess you came back here with your mom, I mean, what was the relationship like with the parents? You said you kind of lived off the land, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
Was it a open-minded household? In terms of, like, I mean, was music?
Oh, yeah, man. Music is always... I started playing violin, which I can't play now to save my life. But that first instrument I ever started to learn was my mom. I think I was 4 years old, would drive me an hour to violin lessons to the nearest town and then drive me an hour back. And my parents always listened to music. My mom played auto harp, singing like a church lady. But, you know, my dad listened. I wrote a blog post one time on my website or on the Rugged and Fancy site my wife and I have about my dad listening to the Doobie Brothers really loud and having a suburban full of kids on a mountain driving up to, like, we were going camping and we were driving on the edge of this mountain. It was just literally, I kept thinking we were going to roll over, and the whole time, like, Old Black Water's playing. That's never left my head.
So even as these granola people, as you put them, I mean, they were into pop music.
They were into, I don't know about pop, but they were into, yeah, they were into music. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Very much so. Yeah. I mean, my dad and mom were, my mom, I grew up hearing opera and classical music every weekend. I would wake up to the sounds of opera being played in our house. My grandmother in Franklin, Tennessee, I'd wake up. She always started the day having music on throughout the house. My mom's brother, my Uncle Mike, who passed away, was a huge influence on me. He listened to everything from Elvis to the Beatles to classical to country. He was just a complete audiophile. And then with having an older brother and sister, you know, they obviously turned me on to stuff, especially my brother, because when he got his first guitar, I wanted a guitar, you know, because he had one. I wanted to be like my brother,
mm-hmm.
and he taught me to play my first songs on guitar.
What were those?
I think the first thing we learned together was the intro, this guitar picking part to Is There Anybody Out There on Pink Floyd's The Wall.
Yeah.
So that was the first, like, finger picking thing I learned.
Do you still play that?
No.
No?
No, I haven't thought about that. It's funny, I used to know more complicated pieces when I was younger, but I didn't keep playing them.
Is your family in Alabama right now?
No.
Brother and sister?
No.
Are you in touch with them?
Yeah. Yeah, but my sister's in Georgia. She lives with my mother, and my brother's in Nashville. So, in the South? Oh, yeah.
Okay, so yeah. It's a Southern family.
It's a Southern family. My dad's in Arizona now, but he just moved out there.
You still in touch with him a good bit?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, mm-hmm. you know, it's interesting because as you and I were talking, again, going back to you having a baby on the way, a boy, and, you know, use the term, you know, you're going to be raising a man, raising him to be a man. And you talk about how, you know, going to a barbershop, for instance, is one of the ways you can, that helps you become a man. It seems like masculinity and manhood are important to you.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that started when you were a kid? Are these ideas that you have about how you would raise your kid, are those influenced at all by your own childhood and your relationship with your dad?
Completely. By my dad and my grandfather.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I mean, my dad, and I spent every summer with my father. So even after my parents divorced, I was with my father every summer. And we would be on, you know, our ranch, and I would work on the ranch, hunt, fish. I mean, being a man is more than just that stuff, you know? It's about how you carry yourself. How do you take care of your wife? And so that's what's important to me. Like, I think there's whole generations of guys that don't know how to turn a screwdriver. And that's just kind of crazy to me. You know, like, everything that I'm putting into action in my life now, I didn't understand it when I was in my early 20s, when my daughter was born. I didn't know what it meant to be a father. I didn't know what it meant to be a husband. I was young and stupid and wanting to be a rock star, and I was really naive. And through going through, you know, the experiences I went through getting arrested and everything else, I woke up real fast and realized my grandfather and my dad had been trying to teach me stuff that I should have been paying attention to, and I finally started putting it into action. But yeah, I look back through my childhood very fondly. I had a great upbringing, man. Even with parents being divorced, I was very fortunate that I had incredible people in my life.
So your dad was a farmer, it sounds like?
No, well, you know, we just kind of survived. I mean, my dad's a carpenter. He's an incredible craftsman. When I was a kid, he used to race motorcycles for Husqvarna. He was a motorcycle racer, rode in the rodeo, wanted a ranch, and we moved to Wyoming with some other family and bought a ranch. And back then, we lived. You know, there wasn't my dad going to a 9-to-5 job. It was like, no, we wake up and you are with your family and you're growing your vegetables or you're making butter. Like, we used to make our own butter and we'd trade stuff with other ranchers. And that's the stuff I remember. I don't remember my dad like going to work until I was older, and he had a car dealership, was a mechanic. My dad was always, he was like a man's man. Mm-hmm. He could fix anything, build anything. Tough dude, but tenderhearted. And that's how my grandfather was too. Both of my grandfathers. My dad's father died when I was younger, so I didn't get to spend as much time with him. But my mom's father, who I'm named after, Bob Duquette, Robert Joseph Duquette. Yeah, I learned a lot from him.
Was religion a big part of the household growing up?
Yes. It was a big part. I mean, my mom, we were always in church. I didn't understand what it was until I was older, what it meant to believe in God and have a relationship with God. And I have my own meaning of that through my faith. I mean, I am a Christian. And, you know, it's funny, I have people that'll try and bait me into arguments. And I'm like, I don't have to argue with you because I'm just telling you what my faith is and what it means to me. And it's on you to determine the rest.
And you can hear it in your music, too. I mean, religion seems to be a pretty prevalent theme throughout a lot of your stuff. Why is that important, to blend it?
Well, with my belief and my faith, the only reason I make music is because God calls me to. Writing songs is a gift. I'm not a technically skilled musician. I don't know I can't jump up with a band and start playing guitar solos. I'm a songwriter. I've always written songs. I have since I was a kid. And so there was themes there before I became a Christian, when I was like really lost and doing a ton of drugs. And I had a writer here in Birmingham one time that called me a cliche of rock and roll. And she did it under an anonymous name, which was hilarious. I was like, look, if you want to have a dialogue with me, just say it. Because it's not a cliche for me. Like, my faith is my faith. And I was always searching for something. But then when I became a Christian, I focused on scripture. And how does that influence my life and my writing? And it's not about religion to me. It's about having a relationship with God. And so religion gets in the way of having a relationship with God, I think. And when I was at Rafa, instead of going to prison, I got to do 6 months as a state inmate at a rehab facility. And there I had really good mentors that encouraged me to keep writing music and to write whatever God put on my heart, no matter what it was. So that started with the Etowah record, to where I really honed in on that.
Did music start becoming a real thing and a lifestyle for you, and something that you knew that you wanted to actually pursue? Was it relatively young?
Oh, yeah, it was in high school.
Yeah.
I always tried to perform songs for family members my whole life, and passed the violin. I took piano, tried to take guitar, but I was a rowdy kid. I kept breaking bones, and I mean, I've broken my right arm like 18 times and my left arm like 16 times.
What are you, skateboarding?
Skateboarding, motorcycles, BMX, dislocated my both my kneecaps a bunch, had surgery on my right knee, most of my ribs. I've had too many concussions. The last one I almost didn't recover from.
Are those days behind you now?
I hope so. Yeah, I hope so. I mean, because the last concussion I had, I fell off a ladder.
Oh, man.
And I didn't talk for months.
When was this?
A few years ago. A few years ago, I was doing a bunch of work for Jones Valley Teaching Farm and got attacked by wasps and landed on my head. Fell about 15 feet onto my head, and I had no memory, no short-term memory during all that time. I couldn't talk, I couldn't drive, I couldn't sing, I couldn't write. True, incredibly true story. We went to a meeting with our pastor, and he called in the elders from our church, and everyone prayed over me. And the next day, I woke up being the dork that I've always been, just being a goofball, you know. As normal as I can be, you know.
So, what was the first band?
First band, I tried to put a band together at boarding school, and we did this like performance at our high school where we wrote two songs, and then we did like Camper Van Beethoven and The Grateful Dead and a bunch of cover songs like that. And then immediately when I left boarding school, I started my first band called Volume, and that evolved into Verbena. It was the same members, but we just kept changing names.
And so that wasn't while you were in Chattanooga, Verbena.
No, that was, I came back to Birmingham in 1991.
Okay, and you met, I mean, you made friends or
Jerry? No,
friends?
I knew Scott Bondi, who goes by A.A. Bondi. A.A. and Lester Newby and I were already, we all knew each other.
Yeah.
And, you know, we put together a band, and it just kept evolving.
Yeah, band, like you said, founded in the early 90s, saw one or two lineup changes over the years. What does that kind of turnover do for a young band in Alabama?
Well, we, you know, the most lineup changes, like at first there's me and Bondi and Les and this drummer, Carson. And then we brought Anne Marie in, and Les was going to college. And then we had a different drummer, Louis Schifano, who was in a band, Remy Zero, but it was always Scott and I. You know, no matter what happened, Bondi and I were together through stuff. And we tried to keep it that way, even when we hated each other, because, man, if a band breaks up because you're not getting along, I mean, that's like we've talked about marriage a little bit, you and I driving around. A band is like a marriage.
Well, why did you hate each other at any point?
You just get on each other's nerves. Maybe not necessarily hate each other, but right. You get on each other's nerves, you know?
Along.
Yeah, you just don't get along on stuff, but you keep working together and you work through it. And I think that's what gave us a lot of strength, because we had a lot of traction for a band back in the 90s before there was internet. You know, we were touring the country and the world with Foo Fighters and Pavement and Bonnie Prince Billy. And
well, and then tell me if I'm correct here, you left the band
before
you recorded, or before the band recorded with Capitol Records.
Yeah, we signed to Capitol. I was still in the band. We signed to Capitol. And I parted ways with the band about a week before recording Into the Pink.
Why?
Weren't getting along.
Wow. I mean, y'all's big break, right? I mean, and
big
then...
break. I just had a kid. I was fed up. There's two sides to every story. I don't a lot of times talk about why we split, because it's personal between me and them.
Right.
But man, at that time when you're young and you get major labels throwing millions of dollars at you and blowing up your ego, and I mean blowing up your ego, things get dicey.
Mm-hmm.
Focus, you lose focus shift. You know, you're no longer concerned about like what's made you a strong band. You're like, well, you don't fit in, or you don't want to do this, and you don't want to party this, or there's a million reasons, but I was just done. And so when they said they didn't want to play with me, I walked away.
I mean, when, like you said, all that money is being thrown at you and they're blowing up your ego, is that something that you just didn't respond well to personally? Or is that the life you were working towards?
No, at the time, for years, it was the life I was working towards. When I was doing, tons of cocaine in my life, what some people don't know is it wasn't out of addiction. It was out of the fact that I thought I needed to do that to be a rock star, and for my image, that I needed to be as Keith Richards as I could be for my legend. I mean, I did stuff on purpose thinking I needed to do it, and it was dumb. So, no, it was signing to Capitol and everything. It was right up where I wanted to be. I wanted to be a big musician.
Yeah. Well, I mean, is that the time, like you said, when you were doing drugs?
I wasn't even doing drugs back then except for smoking weed.
Okay, so once you left Verbena, where did you go from there? Is that when all that started?
When I left Verbena, I was focusing on my band Cut Grass. I just had a kid.
Yeah.
I had to go get a regular job. You know, I was fixing copy machines. And then over time, out of boredom, I started, you know, doing harder drugs. And that just evolved. And I got divorced. I was dating a rock star after my divorce. And yeah, man, I was chasing something. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I was missing stuff in my life. I wasn't doing, I mean, some people define drugs differently than others. But my hardcore drug use came post Verbena, like all the hard drugs like cocaine and stuff. I was just a mess, you know, and I became more of a mess.
Yeah.
Really. I mean, I was good for a while and then I became more of a mess, and I didn't want to give up music, and I fought it tooth and nail, and yeah, I just made a lot of dumb decisions. But I'm grateful for everything I've done because of where I am now.
Right. Right.
I wouldn't change any of it.
So you mentioned already that, you know, you spent some time in jail.
Mm-hmm.
And was there a long period between when you left Verbena and when you started getting into drugs, as you mentioned, then when you went to jail? I mean, how long?
Just a few years.
Yeah.
It went downhill really quick.
Yeah.
Because I didn't deal with my divorce when it happened.
Mm-hmm.
And so and people used to joke, man, like about me being bored. I mean, you know, there's that old saying, the idol's hand is the, idle mind is the devil's play place or playpen, whatever the saying. I'm completely messing it up, but it was that way for me, you know, like if I was bored, I'd be like, well, I might as well go do a bunch of blow. I ain't got nothing else to do.
Yeah.
And so it went from, I got divorced in 2001 and I was arrested the fall of 2002.
What were your charges?
Felony possession of cocaine and misdemeanor possession of marijuana.
Yeah.
Now, and this is where the drug laws in America are ridiculous.
Okay.
I get arrested, and I'm real frank about my feelings on this. I got arrested for residue in a baggie, and they wanted to send me to prison with hardened criminals for 10 years. How does that help anybody?
Yeah.
There was no help. I would have come out of there a criminal. I'd never been in trouble in my life, you know? Like, I was lost and struggling and needing help. You know, to send someone to 10 years in prison for residue in a baggie like I'm carrying heavy drugs, I could stab a man and do less time.
Yeah.
For me, I was fortunate that I got to go to, when they sentenced me, I finally got a lawyer that could talk to the judge, and he let me go to a rehab facility as a state inmate, and that saved my life.
When you were arrested, how did you handle that?
Man, I got pulled over on the interstate. I was completely messed up, had been up in the woods at the Ocoee rafting and camping and doing drugs, and was driving back and had done drugs and, you know, got pulled over. And I mean, I was literally a walking banner for search this guy's cars. You know, my car was trashed. I was wearing a Grateful Dead shirt that that Ryan Adams had given me years prior. And half the stuff I owned was in my car. I didn't have a home at the time. I was couch surfing. And the guy, I told him I had some pot in the car, but I didn't know I hadn't thrown my cocaine baggie out, and he found it. And the Etowah County Sheriff's Department tried to get me to go do buys for them and stuff. And I said, you know what? I'm a grown man. Nobody made me do these drugs. You can take me to jail. That's bottom line. And so I went to jail, and I tried to skip through parts of going through drug court and everything else. I tried to pay my way out of it, so to speak. I'm not bribing anybody. I just mean like paying so much money in fines, it kind of goes away.
Yeah.
But that didn't work. And I was just bucking everything.
Yeah.
You know.
You know, you mentioned that you were doing drugs because you felt like you had to.
Yep.
Was there ever a point where you liked it, where you embraced it, or did you just get lost in doing
what you... I got lost in it, man.
Yeah.
When I think back to doing all the cocaine I did, all I think about is misery.
Yeah. Not a happy time.
Hell no. Yeah. And I laugh I laugh about it a lot now. Like when I played this library the other night and I was making jokes, I could tell people in the room got really quiet, and I'm like, y'all, it's okay to laugh. Because, man, if you can't laugh about coming through all that,
right,
like what are you going to do in life? But no, there was times where I was maybe enjoying it,
yeah,
but not the next day when I woke up. I mean, man, I lost everything through that.
Yeah.
I had no car, no guitar, no amplifier. When I went to jail, man, I came out of there with a 67 Ford pickup truck I was lucky to get and a guitar that my wife and the owner of the rehab had bought me. And that was it.
Were you reaching out to anybody at that point?
No.
No family? No, the Verbena people?
I didn't reach out to anyone, and I had a lot of people that would buy drugs from me on a Friday night, professional business people, and then turn around and tell their wives I was a piece of crap. There's lyrics about that in songs, you know, just, you know, no one reached out to me, and I certainly didn't reach out to anyone.
In a recent interview, you said that when you were locked up, you thought you were going to prison, and you assumed that you would never write music again.
Yep.
When did you realize, I have to write music, and I am going to write music again?
Well, sitting in, at first, yeah, I thought I'd never, I was like, well, this is it. I'm gone for at least 10 years.
This is rock bottom for you?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm, you know, I was about to turn 32 years old. You know, you go serve 10 years on a federal charge. I mean, you know, that's felony. I'm not going to get a job. I'm not going to vote. I'm not going to have a gun. You know, all the stuff that good Southern men like to do. And I got really delirious in jail, and it was the way I coped with it and dealt with it, having people threatening to kill me. I mean, I'm locked up with murderers and rapists and drug kingpins, and I weighed 115 pounds. And at one point, I found a letter the other day I wrote to my wife where I had the idea for the song Don't Go Back to Etowah. And that's when I was like, I'm going to keep writing. Whether I have a guitar or not, I can write. because I had written songs before. I knew what key to write them in. I could hear the melody and know what key I needed to be in and write the song. And then on my 32nd birthday, I found out that I was going to get to go to this place, Rafa, instead of going to prison, with the stipulation of if I leave Rafa, I go straight to prison, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you sort of experienced a bit of a rebirth, not only as a person, but as a musician.
Completely.
Or, I mean, maybe they're synonymous for you in your experience.
They are, yeah.
Yeah.
Music is part of me through and through.
Yeah.
Always will be. I've told people, I'm like, even if I had to go get some cube desk job, which would never happen because I wouldn't know what to do, I'm always going to make records. Always. As long as you know, the good Lord lets me make records, I will make records.
So out came Etowah.
Yep.
Were you writing these songs? You mentioned Don't Go Back to Etowah. Were you writing these other songs while you were there?
I wrote Don't Go Back to Etowah. I wrote actually in jail. The rest of everything, when I got to Rafa, I wasn't allowed to have a guitar, but they had one in the chapel that was from like the 1800s. And then when they let me start playing it, I would go in there every day and write. And then when it came time, you go through 7 weeks of these classes about chemical dependency, and you have to deal with your childhood. And that's when I realized, man, I've had a good life. I'm being a brat and just was partying, you know?
Yeah.
And the second phase is you have to get a job. Well, they came to me with this job placement lady, and she was like, well, where have you worked? What have you done? And I said, well, I've been a chef and a musician. And they were like, well, we can't get you a job doing any of that. And the owner of the rehab and the executive director came to me and asked what I wanted to do. And I said, at the time, I said, I want to write a new record and I want to try and write a book. And I still have this idea for this book, but they created a job for me driving guys to work. So other guys that had jobs, whereas before they were trying to find rides and it was always tricky, they would pay me a very small, like $10 a week, something crazy, silly, and cheap to drive them to work in one of the rehab vans. So I would wake up every morning at 4:30, drive guys to factory jobs, construction jobs, come back to Rafa, and write music all day long, unless they needed me to run an errand. And I would go in the chapel and write for hours. That's all I did. And I would just, at night, during the daytime, I would go just stand in there and find the best sound and place and keep writing songs. And so I wrote most of Etowah there, and I finished it out in Wyoming. I had a good friend that flew me out there when I got done, because I stayed on an extra 3 months at Rafa and was, I mean, I worked, I was the resident advisor, and they would have wanted me to stay full time, but I just, that's not what I was called to do.
Well, so you're forever attached to that place, Etowah.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's the name of your album. I mean,
yep,
it played a huge role in your life. I mean, when you think about Etowah now, what's your memory?
Well, there's a lot of different memories. I mean, the memory of jail is like, holy crap, I can't believe I went through that. And then the memory of going through Rafa is one of growth and change and realizing, just beginning to realize where I'd gone wrong and what I needed to start doing.
And then you just started cranking out music.
And then I started cranking out music.
So, I mean, I know that this is kind of a silly way to put this, but has music been a lifesaver for you? Or were there other factors in your life that contributed more than music did?
No, music is a lifesaver for me.
Yeah.
Hands down. I mean, I don't know how people experience life without music. I really don't.
Mm-hmm.
It conveys so much emotion and passion and love and anger and frustration. You know, music's always been an outlet for me to express my journey and my story. And each record, I feel like I'm just getting started.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, you said that you like to tell stories when you perform.
Mm-hmm.
You obviously tell stories with your music.
Mm-hmm.
And it definitely seems like you have many stories to tell
right
now. I mean, I'm sure that storytelling was something you enjoyed prior to these experiences that you've just gone over. But is it hard for you at all? I mean, you're an open book when it comes to your experience there. And, you talk about your drug use. You talk about the time you spent in jail and almost went to prison. But is it ever difficult to convey that? Because in your interviews before, the word fear comes up a lot when you talk about songwriting, whether you're encouraging people to stay fearless with their art.
Yep.
Or the fact that you were fearful that you might not ever write again.
Yeah.
How do you think fear plays into it now? And has that been something that you've thought about as you've been writing?
Oh, yeah. As people, man, we get in our own way all the time. And half the time, man, people, we're afraid to fail. We're afraid we're going to make bad art. We're afraid we're going to be a bad parent. But good night, man. If you go through life like being afraid of that, you are going to miss your life. I don't want to wake up one day, if I live as long as my grandfather did in his 90s, like, I don't want to wake up and go, golly, I wish I would have been more fearless. And working with the right people and surrounding myself with the right people that allow me to be fearless and to experiment with my creativity, it plays a role, but it's just, it encourages me. And my faith plays into that, because that's, I think, what it gives me freedom, you know, to be fearless, because I'm not trying to impress anybody, you know. I'm not perfect. I'm flawed. I make mistakes all the time. But I'm definitely not trying to sit back and not try what I need to try, even if it doesn't work.
You know, you also recommend a right now, you know, attitude, and you encourage artists to be fearless and to not be afraid to experiment or be vulnerable with their music and lyrics. And it seems like vulnerability has played a huge role in your songwriting.
While what I write is very personal, and this is for me, I'm not speaking for other musicians, but, and I'm reminded, like I told you about an email I got from a guy recently that had been listening to Etowah. It helped him through a horrible breakup he was going through. Like, sometimes you may be writing something and it has nothing to do with you, but if you're vulnerable, people can relate to that. Everyone's got issues. Everyone's got problems. There's some bumper sticker that's like, remember that everyone you meet today is fighting a great fight or a great struggle. That's true. So I don't want it to be about me, and I want to, it's tough because I like to be a very private man. You know, I'm not good at asking for help. I'm about to have a kid in my house and ready, and I have people volunteering to help, but I for some reason can't say, hey, will y'all come over and help me paint my house? Cause I don't know.
Maybe you don't want the help.
Yeah.
I mean, do you feel like, going back to the whole manhood issue, do you feel like,
oh yeah, well, there's definitely a part where I was like, I'm a man, I should be able to handle this.
Do this myself.
Yeah. But there's also another part of being a man is knowing when to ask for help. Right. And I asked people last night, like, hey, when are we going to do this? Like, I got 3 bedrooms to paint here. But
you said recently that until last year, you had never made money in music. And that
I'd paid some bills, but I've never made money.
You said that you nearly lost your house, and you might have had that not happened recently. And I was just going to ask, like, what specifically changed? I mean, was there a certain song that helped your situation that you sold?
Roll Baby Roll had a good placement on a TV show.
Right.
And that sustained me for a while. I mean, because I had been working in production, had a little bit of a falling out with a few people. Yeah, almost lost my home, got months behind on the mortgage. You know, things were really challenging and tough. And I stayed the course, and I will stay the course, you know.
You know, I think there's a cinematic quality to your music,
mm-hmm.
obviously through its imagery. I just think the sound is in a way movie friendly for some reason.
Sure.
And you just mentioned that it's appeared on television before. You said that you're extremely influenced by visuals, and that includes film. You know, I'm just curious, as a film fan, what are some specific examples of how films have shaped your songwriting?
You know, that is kind of tough. Like, on the film aspect, there's moments within films where, like, the right song in the right spot takes a scene from two people, like, having a moment or a group, to it just tearing your soul apart in the most beautiful way, to bringing you incredibly tons of joy and emotion. And I had someone I was recently talking to, like a client that I was doing some consulting for my wife and I's company, trying to explain to them, like, so we shot this video, but if I pull the music out, I guarantee you it's not going to have the same impact. It's very important, because music draws up emotion in everybody. So, you know, moments in Cool Hand Luke, where he's, you know, there's that guy, there's, what's his name, singing in the background all the time, and it's like the Going 90, I'm Not Scared Because I Got the Virgin Mary.
And the Plastic Jesus.
Yeah, Plastic Jesus, which the Flaming Lips covered years later.
Yeah.
Like, man, that scene sticks with you.
Yeah.
And then still images, I started working with photographers like Jason Wallace and Miller Molly, these incredible photographers from Birmingham. And I just, like, the images I noticed, like, the ideas that I would get, like, looking at a painting. It's not just, I mean, it's film, but it's paintings, it's photography. And when I was working for those photographers, it became even more so. The new album, Rabbit Runs a Destiny, started as an album called God Bless This Mess. And that was from a photo I took mm-hmm. on a photo shoot with Jason Wallace after the tornadoes 2 years ago. And that image, I saw it, it stuck with me so much. And I had a conversation with my friend Maddie Diaz about different images. Like, she had done a photo shoot, and she said she wanted to write a record based on this image. And I was going through the same thing. And we talked for hours about trying to create sonically what you're seeing visually and conveying it. That's the word cinematic comes up a lot lately with like Rabbit Runs a Destiny, because I was trying to make a cinematic record, but through sound, you know, to create sonic landscapes. And so I took this image and I started writing based on that image. But then as we got into the production of it, I tried to stay out of the way, and the imagery changed as we like created these soundscapes.
Yeah.
And it wound up to where I took the lyric from that title track and named it the record.
And you've been pleased with the reception so far?
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
I think that we got a ways to go.
Yeah.
But I'm in it for the long haul, you know.
In more ways than one.
Ways than one, yeah.
Duquette Johnson, thanks so much.
Thank you, Ben. I appreciate it.
Yeah.